Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is the mammalian 21st century equivalent of Scrooge McDuck. It's James Hull.
I gotta ask, you know, what's the thought process behind that one?
How is your, like, do you have like a big gold vault that you'll jump into with all your successful, you know, investments?
By the way, I'm pretty sure if you jumped into a gold vault, you would hurt yourself immensely. I wouldn't, you know, I always thought that was kind of weird about that show.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good to be here. I'll just do the disclaimer real quick. Nothing said on this podcast is investment advice, even if it sounds like advice. It isn't. Don't take it as advice. Also, while we try not to, we and our guests may get their numbers wrong. So, you know, do your own research. Also, this podcast is recorded in the past and views expressed here may no longer be relevant by the time you listen to it. So, yeah, do your own research. We should probably add something about, you know, we're not you. You know, we're our own people. So we don't have your interests in mind. We have, you know, our interests, but, you know, we try to disclose everything when
Do your own research.
We do.
Do your own research. That's what we
do. Do your own
say.
Research. Yeah.
And joining us as well, as we're doing earnings today. And every time that we do earnings, or almost every time we do earnings, we have our guest host, our 0.5 host of this podcast, your friend and mine. It's
Michael.
It's Michael Norris.
Was that from The Office?
No, it was from Arrested Development. It was just a clip of Job from Arrested Development saying, Michael. Anyways, it's Michael Norris. Michael, thank you for joining us again, as usual.
Thanks very much. I must admit that I didn't get the bit at the start there, but I'm all clued in. I think it may be because I have never watched Arrested Development.
Yeah, it is. I can't really blame you, but it was.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, you're an Arrested Development fan. You've seen it?
No, it's good.
Yeah, it's a.
I like it. It's pretty good.
Millennial. It's a millennial classic. Anyways, so techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. And yeah, let's just get into it. So we got earnings.
Right.
We've had earnings for the past few weeks, and we can't do all of them today. But let's at least just get into the e-commerce giants, because those seem to be the big splashes, and also those are a lot of the firms that seem to really have been you know, growing a lot in their market cap and the investor interest recently. So we have, of course, Alibaba, JD, and Pinduoduo. James, I want you to share with us. You have kind of set up a few tables here. I think we can include the links in the show notes.
Yeah.
But if you could explain to the listeners exactly kind of how you've been setting up these tables to look at these three firms.
So before I do that, let me just do a quick rundown of sort of the market stats. We got Alibaba. We're talking about Alibaba, JD, and Pinduoduo, the e-commerce guys today. And there's Alibaba's market cap at the time, which is the morning of August 25th, is $746.8 billion. JD's 118.5-ish. Pinduoduo's 113.4. So those are all U.S. dollar market caps. We can also look at kind of EV to sales of the three, and they're all very different. This is trailing sales. So Alibaba's 8.8. JD's 1.1. Pinduoduo is 20 times EV to trailing 12-month sales. And then when we look forward, you know, because Pinduoduo is growing sales pretty quickly, that EV to sales, you know, going forward a year, drops down to 11.5. And then going back up here, JD's goes to 0.9 and Alibaba's goes to 6.76. So Alibaba, I have three metrics. I have annual active buyers, annual spend per buyer, and GMV. So the relationship of these three is basically your GMV divided by your annual active buyers equals your annual spend per buyer on your platform. Okay. So these are all things that are not covered by GAAP accounting rules. These are all kind of, I mean, hopefully it's easy to count annual active buyers, but you know, that's probably the easiest of these to count. The GMV is all kind of a little bit different. There are ways to play with your GMV, and there are reasons why we shouldn't just focus on that, but it is interesting to kind of compare them. So the three rank this way. Alibaba has the largest GMV, and this is just, by the way, for their Tmall and Taobao marketplaces. So they have other marketplaces that aren't included in this. If you include all that other stuff, it's got to be much, much, much larger. But so that's about, I estimate, you know, the most recent quarter, which they just announced earnings, you know, so this would be for the June quarter for all of these firms. So there would be 7.09 is what I have. And that's trillion, I think. So these are in thousands of billion is what I have on this table if anyone pulls it up and is looking at it. JD is 2,400 and Pinduoduo is 1,270. So quite a bit of, you know, range here. Obviously, Alibaba was kind of early on with the very large, you know, kind of consumer to consumer marketplace. And so they grew very fast and got to become the biggest. So then we look at annual active buyers. So we have here the ranking is Alibaba's the biggest, Pinduoduo's second, and then JD's third. So Alibaba's 742 active buyers, Pinduoduo's 683, and JD's 417. And this is this most recent quarter. And then we can look at annual spend per buyer, which is basically, you know, you take this active buyers, divide it by the GMV, or GMV divided by active buyers, and you get this annual spend. So Alibaba, it's kind of interesting. You can look at, I have the last 3 years in here too. So you can see 2017, 2018, pretty flat. And then 2019 kind of grew a little bit. And my estimate, now this is an estimate, so it could be wrong, obviously. But I'm having it, it's had quite a big jump here. So that's at 9,500. JD's at 5,800-ish, you know, and Pinduoduo's just under kind of 2,000 at 1,560. Wait, sorry, 1,860. So, you know, the thing here is this kind of shows you how often people are using the platform, how much they're spending on the platform, and all that ends up flowing to earnings because at least for Alibaba and Pinduoduo, they make the majority of their revenue from kind of a like a monetization rate sort of model where they're monetizing the activity on the marketplace. JD has a fair amount of first party, you know, direct sales. So they're making a margin on that, but they also have been growing their third party platform. So they'll also enter sort of that platform monetization rate model as they keep growing that. So, but it is interesting. I also have some growth rates here and you can see kind of it. I have a kind of a theory that because of Pinduoduo coming into the market and bringing all these, you know, users from kind of lower tier cities, bringing them online, bringing them to the digital e-commerce world, they've managed to create a bunch of more users for JD and Alibaba as well. And you can kind of see, you know, in the last just couple of years, you know, growth rates for JD, but we can get into that. But growth rates for JD did jump up. I mean, they used to be kind of single digits in kind of the Q4 18 to Q2 19 period, year over year. Annual active accounts was basically single digits. And then after Q3 19, it started to go double digit again, which is, you know, I mean, great for JD. So, I mean, it's almost like having more platforms is good for you know, all the other platforms too.
Well, I mean, the way that I've looked at all this is as I think of, there are essentially three stories, and this is the how I've seen it. I don't know if the companies themselves would agree with this, but this is how I would see it, is that, you know, Alibaba is kind of the king, and they've been the king. They're the ecosystem. And the question with them has always been, how do they use their kind of monopolistic power to keep others out, right? JD has been traditionally, I guess, a little bit the more conservative one, the ones that deal more in kind of higher end goods and that try to, you know, capitalize off having kind of a more premium brand. And then Pinduoduo is the disruptor, right? They're the ones who have, you know, have had the growth models. They're the ones who have gone after kind of new, kind of mobile first, as, you know, for our listeners will know that I recently finished researching a white paper on Pinduoduo. And the whole idea is about, you know, find where that penetration is, just the mobile phone penetration is getting, and hit it aggressively and compete, right? So the question with each of these is, you know, how does Alibaba kind of maintain their stronghold? How does is JD able to adjust and adapt and change as quickly as they need to, right? And can Pinduoduo continue to innovate and adapt and find these new kind of funko, right? These new opportunities for growth. But anyways, let's go over to Michael here, and let's just go through company by company here. So let's start with Alibaba. So Michael, your thoughts on Alibaba and their earnings?
Great. So with respect to Alibaba, I guess one of the things that came through strongly was the idea that we're very close to pre-COVID levels. And this sang through all of the earnings calls, is that the online retail spend, speed, velocity seems to look pretty good relative to the rest of the real economy. So just going through some of the top line numbers here, Ali did $21.8 billion in quarterly revenue. So that's plus 34% year on year compared to the quarter in the previous year. There's four segments that Alibaba breaks its results down into. Listeners that are relatively unfamiliar with the business would know, so a trick for listeners that are relatively unfamiliar with the business is just to look at core commerce and cloud. The other two are not worth your time. core commerce revenue looks pretty strong. The customer management revenue, so that is a code for advertising, is up 23%. The commission revenue, how much they make on the commissions on how much is transacted on the platform, that's up 17%. And the interesting thing about core commerce is that it includes online and offline commerce. So Alibaba has a new retail business which straddles both online and offline channels, and it seems to be the big grower at 80% year-on-year growth compared to the previous quarter. So that looks quite good from a core commerce perspective. And just to, I mean, put it into context for folks, when you're looking at Ali's numbers, let's not forget, as James said, that they do about $1 trillion in GMV last year. So, you know, double-digit growth on $1 trillion is pretty handy. And so when you're thinking about Ali's GMV, and you might see that its GMV is slowing a little bit, going from double digit to single digit, just remember that you've got the law of big numbers at play, and an 8% GMV increase on $1 trillion is a lot. And then going into cloud.
Yeah, so
yeah, James, go for
Michael,
it.
Michael, real quick, if I can just, if everyone's looking at this table, you know, the Alibaba's GMV growth from 2017 to 18 to 19 was 19% and then 15%. Their year end for 2019 was Q1 calendar year of this year. So you're only looking at one quarter of change in the most recent quarter here. And that's like not super clear in this chart, in this table, but that's one of the little weird things about comparing these companies. And because Alibaba doesn't give quarterly GMV figures like Pinduoduo does, you know, it's a little different and harder to compare them. But anyway, yep, please go ahead.
No, that's cool. And cloud computing, I'll go over this pretty quickly. So revenues for the quarter up 59% from the year ago quarter. They sit at around $1.75 billion. So of course, if you think about Ali's core commerce revenue, that sits at about $19 billion. So obviously, cloud computing isn't a major part of the revenue split just yet, but it is growing quite healthily. And
it's a reason to invest in them. Like it's such an engine. I mean, it's a big reason why I'm a shareholder of theirs is that, you know, we've seen what cloud has done with Microsoft and Amazon. And if you've we've seen cloud take off in China. Our previous episode was about cloud, but there's just so much room for growth there. I think, you know, that is to me, you know, what makes Alibaba perhaps most appealing.
One, right, the thing I like about cloud computing is like, if when you look at these numbers, like what I do is I put all these numbers into a spreadsheet and I get every quarter and I just line them up. You can kind of see the changes over time. And with Alibaba that has a pretty long reporting history, it's a lot of work to make it, but once you make it, it's pretty sweet. So when you look at cloud computing, it's just this stable business, right? And Q1, which was, you know, their Q4, it grew. Whereas like every other business they have, you know, core commerce, digital media, entertainment, and innovation and initiatives and others, they all declined. But cloud was the one thing that went up in Q1, kind of in the middle of a pandemic and all that. So it kind of shows you there's like a piece of resiliency there that just makes those revenues, I think, you know, they probably should have a higher multiple on them, you know, if you do like a kind of sum of the parts sort of thing here. But anyway, I thought that was very interesting.
Well, the thing with cloud is that to really own cloud, you have to have a lot of muscle. So there's only, you know, a select few companies in the world that can really dominate it. But the other side of that is that it is a direction that continues to have growth year upon year upon year, and there's really no end in sight with it. So, you know, it's obviously there's, you know, kind of monopoly questions, you know, for regulators. But, you know, when it comes to these businesses that are strong in cloud, I can understand why their multiples are so big, because, you know, the sky is the limit in this business. Anyways, Michael. We've been talking over you. Keep going with your thoughts on Alibaba.
No, that's cool. Look, the only last thing I wanted to say is just a little snippet from Daniel Zhang, the CEO. So I'll read verbatim here. COVID-19 has accelerated digital transformation of consumer behavior and enterprise operations. Alibaba is a key beneficiary of this development, with most of our businesses, including core commerce and cloud computing, have recovered and resumed healthy growth. And so that was one of the key takeaways for me now looking forward, is that some of the support that they offered to merchants that might have some negative margin implications may fall away. They've, of course, just finished the second largest e-commerce festival for the year in this reported quarter, 618. And then in Q4 this year, they've got a double 11, double 12. And by that time, the merchant commissions, the amount that they're paying for advertising placement and the like should be back to normal levels. And so I think there's a little bit to look forward to here, irrespective of whether you look at the cloud growth that Elle and James were talking about, or if you're looking at core commerce and where the Chinese consumer is at. I think that there's enough to keep you interested here.
All right,
Michael, that would be very interesting. I think you're just saying that it seems that maybe their margins might improve because they'll kind of cut back on some of those, I guess, loss-making benefits or that they give to customers. Is that right? That's kind of been a story for them for a while. They've, you know, since, you know, they started bringing in Cainiao and local consumer services and kind of these things, their margins have been declining. I mean, core commerce for Alibaba back in 2016, 2017, a little bit, was like a 60% plus EBITDA, so EBITA, margin business, which is just an incredible margin. But since, you know, it's been declining pretty steadily, you know, it's gone from 63 in Q2 17 to Q2 right now of 38%. And that's a little bit of a bounce improvement from 30% last quarter. And kind of the main reasons for that are these, they're including, you know, these Cainiao and local consumer services, I think. But they also have just pulling their entire kind of system EBITDA margin. So all their business segments, including cloud computing, digital media, innovation initiatives, that's also pulling down. I mean, it used to be close to 50% EBITDA margin, and now it's around 30. So it would be very, very interesting and a great thing for them if they can kind of pull that back up. I mean, the CFO and other management on earnings calls do frequently, when they get questions about these margins and kind of their focus, they always say that they're growing kind of the pie, which is the revenues, before they do anything with margins, if they ever do anything. You know, they don't even suggest that usually that they'll do that just yet. But, you know, the idea is it's a land grab.
It's kind of the juggling act that we see with these three, right? That it's, if you focus on margins, someone else is going to focus on growth. I mean, this is how Pinduoduo came to be, you know, 5 years ago, right? Is that you had JD and Alibaba that were like, hey, well, we should start, you know, focusing a little more on margins. And investors in Pinduoduo saw, okay, well, this is an opportunity to grow. And they ran in it, and they were wildly successful. So then now what we see is, you know, we see, okay, you know, Alibaba is like, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't worry about margin so much, right? And then they do better when it comes to their, you know, their top line growth. So it does seem like this is this juggling act. And I think that the conclusion is that investors want to know that a company can increase their margins or cut their losses, whatever it is. But I don't think investors are most happy to see that, at least from my experience, is that I think that what really gets investors juiced is the growth. Do you guys have thoughts on that? That's been kind of my anecdotal takeaway.
Well, that's certainly the case in the last 10 years. I mean, this is, you know, revenue growth is, if you look at kind of different factors, revenue growth is a very big contributor to kind of pause. If you just take revenue growth and probably a large cap kind of factor, combine them, I mean, you're going to have pretty good returns in the last decade. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's particularly, I mean, my personal take is I take a little more nuanced view. You know, if you're focusing on revenue growth and, you know, you don't have a large market to enter, but you keep trying to kind of spend a lot of money to grow and you're not really getting that traction, I mean, that's kind of a bad sign, obviously. But if you have that large market and there is kind of that white space or that TAM, I guess, to use that buzzword, but then go for it. And some, you know, some industries are a little bit different, you know, platforms, e-commerce, digital platforms are tend to be, you know, have a little bit longer runway with these things. You can also get it with, you know, high quality consumer brands can get it. You can get it with like addictive products like tobacco. but it's, I mean, the revenue growth in Chinese e-commerce is probably the most important thing. You know, I think, but you got to look, like my right. thing is you got to look beyond just the revenue and see what the quality of that revenue growth is. And so, you know, if you're spending a lot of money on marketing and subsidies and coupons and promotions and things like that, I would count mm-hmm. that as like lower quality revenue growth. And if you're getting kind of organic growth, like JD is really impressive. I'm kind of kicking myself for not owning them, but they've done a really good job kind of transforming their business a bit. But let's kind of focus on Alibaba. I think there's...
What more do we need to say about Alibaba before we move on to JD, by the way? Because I thought that was a great opportunity to segue.
Yeah, it is. The only thing that I'll say before we move on really quickly is that the margin expansion to when you get back some of that merchant advertising revenue and the like, I don't think that solves the structural problem, James. I don't want it to be sort of conveyed that that's what I think. Because Alibaba is now a business that straddles online and offline. And the fact of the matter is, when it comes to e-commerce platforms, if you look globally, China, US, Latin America, Europe, North America, sorry, I've said North America twice, the margins on e-commerce platforms, irrespective of whether it's a retail first model or whether it's a marketplace-based model, aren't as good as you think they right. are. So, I mean, e-commerce is not a business where you make a lot of money. You make the money on the digital advertising, if you make much money at all. And so this is that's the part of the business that might get better margins. But of course, that doesn't materially change the fact that because they've got these physical businesses or businesses that are in the intersection of physical and digital sort of applying gravity to the margin, you are going to have continued lower margins. And this is where I think somebody like Tim Culpin, who's a very sharp guy, like his writing, but...
And friend of the pod. Friend He's of been the on pod, the pod a number of times.
Friend of the podcast. The obsession that he has with margin, that decline in margins, I think to some degree is a little misplaced, given that they've got a business that now straddles both online and offline. And so the unlock is going to be if they are able to spin out the logistics or the local services business. And if you look on, you know, the Chinese internet and you search for that rumor mill and you start looking at that rumor mill, there have been some rumblings that they're going to spin those businesses out. And then that makes the Alibaba that we know now return back to an online only or more online than offline, which is very interesting.
I'm sure they'll retain ownership to some degree.
Of course.
And they might even quarter to quarter be some changes there. But maybe separately these businesses would get, you know, what's like one massive benefit of spinning those things out and listing them is that the management of those teams can get, you know, stock options that will reflect the performance that their kind of group does. And so, you know, if they spin out like their Cainiao logistics or local services, I mean, you'd have something that maybe is a little more comparable to Meituan with the local services. And so you can, you know, maybe the idea is you get a Meituan-like multiple, which would obviously be a big benefit, I think. And Cainiao, maybe something there with JD Logistics, you know, you could have two groups, you know. Anyway, this is kind of interesting.
What's insane though is think about how, so if when we talked about how, you know, e-commerce itself is never really profitable, right? It's something that, you know, if you want to focus on growth, you know, that it's often subsidized. But if you look at Alibaba, the amount of wealth they have created off the back of e-commerce, whether it's, you know, Ant Financial and creating the world's biggest bank, essentially, off the back of their e-commerce, whether it be their local services, their cloud business. It really is incredible what Alibaba has done with that e-commerce flywheel. I mean, it doesn't get enough attention, and it gets a lot of attention as it is.
Oh yeah.
So anyways, we should move on to JD. I'm going to have to put my foot down here as the moderator of the podcast. JD,
should I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead. So JD,
should I kick it off? All right, so we got annual active accounts are up 30% year over year. We got revenues up 34% on the quarterly year over year basis. I mean, it's all looking pretty good. You know, they have product revenues. That's up 33%. And then they have another segment called services and other. That's up 36%. And that's been pretty strong. I mean, the slowest growth that had was last quarter. That was a 30% growth. But before that, it was, you're looking at a 44, maybe all the way up to like in the low 50s. So pretty strong. Let's see. Their gross margin, you know, we can also look at all three of these companies on a gross margin basis, which is also kind of interesting. But JD's gross margin, and I'll just do it on a trailing 12-month basis, is about 14.6. That's steadily kind of improving a little bit, you know, here and there. Operating margin, also trailing 12 months, been improving very nicely, is 2%. It used to be roughly negative back in 2018. And kind of went positive 2019, and that's because they were doing this big investment push into their logistics business and kind of making those changes. And then let's see, let's also look at, I guess, non-GAAP net income's also doing well. Trailing 12 months also around 2%, and then the quarter was 2.9. So it's pretty solid. Sales and marketing expenses are just 3.4%. Revenue, cost of revenues are high because they have quite a bit of, first party direct sales. So cost of revenues is about 85%. I think JD, one of the things I thought was very interesting is when you look at their press release on the Kuayue Express, they acquired a controlling interest in Kuayue Express. They describe themselves as China's leading technology driven e-commerce company transforming to become the leading supply chain based technology and service provider. So that's pretty interesting. I mean, when I read that, I just think the word platform kind of pops into my head, and it's this kind of focused platform that's, you know, supply chain based technology and service provider, which is, I think it's an interesting place. I feel like JD's really carved out sort of a niche for themselves, and they're the leader in it, and you have kind of, you know, obviously this has been a story we've talked about before, but, you know, Alibaba trying to kind of get into logistics through Cainiao, you know, because they kind of see JD as kind of strong in that area, and maybe they need to kind of step it up. But it's just interesting. I think, yeah, I mean, just looking at their annual spend per buyer, right? Like we said before, you know, 5,850. I mean, that's very strong. It's been pretty stable, though. It's kind of had single digit growth last year, but the year before it grew 24%. So there's, you know, they're probably getting, I mean, Michael, I know you want to talk about their FMCG products and fresh produce and kind of take a look at their revenue. But I think that's, you know, you get kind of more touch points with that type of stuff, although the order sizes are lower than the technology, consumer electronics that used to kind of dominate their revenue. But anyway.
Michael, your thoughts.
What do you think, Michael?
So I am doing a wholesale relook at JD. I'm doing a wholesale relook at JD for a couple of reasons. The first is that this level of revenue growth and customer count is the highest that it's been since 2017. And what I think is really interesting about both the revenue and the new customers that are coming through is making me do a relook. So looking at the revenue first, on the call, JD said that its supermarket category, including FMCG and fresh produce, became the single largest product category of revenue in half one 2020, surpassing mobile phone, home appliance, home computers, and our numerous champion categories. So to me, that's blown the bloody doors off, because before, JD to me was mobile phone, home appliance, home computers, and a little bit extra. Now you've got the FMCG and fresh produce, and of course, FMCG is huge. So what it exactly is very important for me to understand, to get across, as you said, James, the touch points, the frequency, the average order size, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one area where now I have to do a whole new relook. Yes.
So what do you think that's like? Do you think that's going to be sticky? Because, I mean, obviously it's driven by the pandemic in Q1 and then kind of the fear, which based on my kind of feelers, I got a sense that, you know, some of my friends and their friends and people, at least in Beijing, were pretty worried and were not really going out and shopping, even into Q2, when the virus seemed to be pretty well controlled towards the end of Q2. I mean, I could totally see people using, you know, fresh produce and buying more clothes and other kind of things and FMCG products more on e-commerce. And maybe that's kind of the drive. But is that like, are those changes, is that kind of derivative growth there? Is that something we can look forward to? Or is that kind of just a one-time jump, you think?
Yeah, great question. So we have done, we do a lot of surveys on just general app usage and the like, and the numbers for JD, even coming back when now that I think about it, even end of last year looked pretty strong. I think the pandemic experience in Q1 has driven the preference for JD same day delivery, the idea that you wake up, you look in the kitchen cabinet and you go, shit, I'm out of X, Y, and Z. You go on.
I've never done that before, ever.
I have.
Yeah.
You go on JD and you know that it'll arrive same day, 4 o'clock before you come back home from work for your cooking that evening. And I think that has driven some increased stickiness with JD. So I think that's good news. And the fact that that's continued over to...
That's what I love about JD.
To quarter two, I think helps you answer in part some of that stickiness question. Because if it wasn't sticky, that Q2 snapback would have been greater than what it was. So that's the revenue side. And then the other side that makes me do this wholesale relook is the user growth, because JD launched a number of different social commerce apps. So there's Jingxi, which is the one that gets most airtime. Then there's Fengxiang, and then there's Xiaojingdian. And then for me, breaking down the different trajectories, the different types of user that's using these apps, I mean, there's a lot of homework to be done for me to get across and get comfortable with these new acquisition channels. And then also in the call, they talked about the collaboration with Kuaishou, which of course is a huge short video application in and of its own right, 400 million monthly active users, and I think it's 300 million active daily users. You know, that's significant. And so this is what they had to say on their collaboration with Kuaishou. So far, our collaboration's focused on self-operated products. So that's the stuff they sell themselves. 400 SKUs are on the product right now with favorable prices. So that means it's probably a close to cost or even a loss leader at this point. But the most exciting thing is in the future, we'll continue to open our SKU selections and we're acting together in close partnership with Kuaishou. Then you couple that information, the social commerce, the short video, with the idea that 80% of new users are coming through lower tier cities, and you start to get a picture of, okay, this is a new commerce format that JD has been a little bit late to the party with, but seems to have accrued some serious traction. And I put that down to the CEO of JD Retail, Xule, who's a very, very, very competent guy. For those that can speak Chinese, it's worth digging up some of his interviews. He's got his head screwed on right, fairly articulate, and he seems to be the driver in, as Richard Liu's taken a wee bit of a backseat for numerous reasons, of getting a few of these initiatives over the line and really putting their pedal to the metal here. So I'm doing a wholesale relook on that basis.
Yeah, yeah. I want to add a few things here. One is I'm totally on board with you. I think I remember the first time we had you on the pod, none of us are very optimistic about JD. JD over the last year has been very impressive with how they've responded to kind of their competitive challenges and their internal challenges as well, and continued to do what they do best, which is focus on their competences and respond to shareholder demands. What excites me the most about JD is that they have the market cornered on, if you need something today, and it must be there today, and it must be there in good condition, right? This is why JD Health, I think, is such a great business, because they, if you need a prescription drug tomorrow, they'll get you that prescription drug tomorrow, right? It's these, the urgency-based, time-sensitive, quality-sensitive logistics, JD, really, whether or not they actually have the logistics of it cornered, I mean, and it seems that they do, they have the branding behind it cornered, which often matters just as much. The second thing is that what we've seen, I think, pretty much for the last decade, is that JD has not always been the innovator, but they have been a competitor who can copy with quality. Well, what was it, James? I think about a year ago, when we listened to their quarterly, their earnings call, and I think you had mentioned something that, but what was it that Richard Liu was on there, and he's like, we will copy what the competitors are doing, and we will do it very good, or something like that.
Yeah, that was kind of like they were making a bunch of shots across, basically Alibaba and JD were taking shots across Pinduoduo's bow without actually mentioning their name, and just, basically insinuating that they're going to go after those lower tier customers. They're going to, they did Jingxi, they did the Xiaojingdian thing. I mean, this is all kind of, if something's working in China, kind of the way it works is that everyone else kind of starts trying to do it too. Just kind of how it is. Yeah.
But copy and copy better is what they do, I think. So that whatever you do in e-commerce in China, whatever area you innovate in, whether it's Alibaba or Pinduoduo or anyone else, the idea is that oftentimes, give JD some time and they can figure out how to do it and bring their kind of brand muscle and logistics muscle, to that arena. And it's going to be quite difficult, which is why continuing to innovate is such an important thing with these companies. Anyways, anything else you want to say about JD? I'm going to check the time. I'm going to give you guys 2 minutes to say anything else you guys have to say about JD.
I mean, I'll just kind of, the kind of a full look back here. I mean, back when we first started the podcast and we're talking about JD, they were basically doing this investment in their logistics business. They were losing money on an operating income. It was kind of, there was a lot of skepticism in the market. But, they've literally done it. I mean, I think they can call a pretty, you know, pat themselves on the back here, because what used to be losses in operating income is now, you know, four or six consistent quarters of positive operating. And this is GAAP, no non-GAAP sort of shenanigans here. Consistent positive operating income, which is, you know, I mean, they should get props for that. I think it's good. It's impressive. And then what they're seeing is, it looks like they are doubling down on this, you know, this idea of transforming to kind of really become the leader in the supply chain based technology and service provider. Anyway, it's, I mean, I'm sounding kind of promotional here, but I think, you know, this is, it's, I don't know, I'm impressed. I think they've done a good job. And I think shareholders have been, you know, if you bought back then, you've definitely been rewarded. I mean, there were some funds that, because of what happened with Richard Leo, you know, that they were kind of forced to sell because, you know, just moral and whatever social obligations, ESG stuff, maybe.
And a key man risk as well, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, if you were able to buy in the middle of that kind of storm, I mean, obviously you've done quite well. And, you know, there are some people that have done that, and, you know, props to them for doing it, you know.
All right. Well, let's move on here to the third of the three, which is Pinduoduo. Their investors responded kind of less positively to them than to JD and Alibaba. I mean, it's not that they had a particularly bad, you know, earnings report, but you know, for a company that was $33 a share in March, and let's see, $93 a share in July. I mean, they are loaded with investor expectations, and you know, they're playing with very high stakes at the moment. Who wants to go first on this one?
Yeah, happy to lead us off here. Look, the key takeaway for me from this one was the mismatch between investor expectations and what was delivered. And the second thing was the agriculture push. So let's take those in turn. In terms of what they delivered, just having a look here. So in the last 12 months, their GMVs increased 79% to 1.27 trillion RMB. And they say that that's the result of higher user engagement and increased spending per user. For me, that was the number that triggered the collapse in the stock price. So I think it was down 13% on the day. For those that are interested in what 13% at, you know, 100 billion plus market cap is, that's the equivalent to the market cap of Bilibili. So they lost the equivalent of a Bilibili in a day. And it was on the basis of that number. In my humble estimation. And the reason why is because I reckon the market had priced in triple-digit GMV increase there. And indeed, this was raised on the call, and it just shows you that the investor expectation, I mean, to be able to keep up triple-digit GMV increases is at this scale as well, like PDD has got scale to it now, I think was unrealistic, and I think that lofty expectation wasn't quite met. The other number that was a little bit funny was, and by funny I mean a wee bit of a turnoff for investors, was the annual spending for active buyers in the 12-month period. So the 12-month period from June 30, 2019 to June 30, 2020, increased 27% to 1,857 RMB. They've added a lot of new users in the last 12 months, and they said on the call that, you know, we're expecting that number will be slightly higher, but I don't think investors can expect that number to go too high too fast. And the reason why is because e-commerce,
especially if they want margins, that's for sure.
Well, that's one part, but there's two dirty secrets in China's e-commerce landscape. The first is that 50% of the orders come from three administrative units in China. Shanghai, Zhejiang, Guangdong. The second is that if you speak to Ali, if you speak to JD, or if you speak to Pinduoduo, especially category managers, there are whales. So e-commerce whales. So the average that a punter will spend on PDD is, you know, something like 1,857 RMB, but there are whales that spend disproportionately more than that. And the allocation of whales between Ali, JD, and Pinduoduo means that Pinduoduo will have less whales and very less really active high value buyers for some time. And so the question for PDD, how does it attract those folks onto its platform? And then the last thing that I'll say here is just about the revenue growth. So the percentage increase is good, 67%. But note that the revenue compared to the other three is not in the same ballpark. And this I covered at the start of the year in my my first article about PDD, saying that it's got big league users. So in terms of active buyers, it's 683 million. Taobao Tmall all up has 247 million, if my numbers aren't wrong. So it's got the Alibaba scale, but the amount of revenue that it makes is paltry compared to the others. And this I flagged as a big problem, and clearly others feel the same way, because before the earnings and after the earnings, Bank of America, BoCom, UBS, and Barclays have re-rated PDD. And I think that this is a function, and all of those re-rates were in a downward direction, so from either a buy to a neutral or to remain neutral. And I think this is because of the GMV miss, and I think it's because the revenue and the average user spend isn't where we thought it would be, because the story that we've been sold so far is we're using the Baibu here, this 100 billion RMB subsidy program, to get at some of the whales that JD has and try and attract people who are interested in buying high-value goods onto PDD. I don't think that strategy has been reflected in the numbers, and I think some analysts are having some second thoughts too, especially when you go back and you read the transcript. Alicia Yap, Tina Long both asked about this question, and I think that's sufficient evidence that you know there's a few folks that are going right now. James,
yeah, I mean, this kind of reminds me of the whole Tesla, you know, kind of predicament. I like, you know, Pinduoduo is selling Teslas on their platform. Tesla says that, you know, the cars sold on Pinduoduo's platform don't adhere to their delivery policy, and so they need, like, those people need to get refunds and they need to buy them directly from Tesla. But, you know, that those little kind of gimmicks, you know, selling a few cars here and there, you know, like high priced items, are what, you know, you throw that into your, you know, GMV, and then you kind of start to get a little bit higher annual spend per active buyer, right? So, but that's kind of a gimmicky way of doing it instead of like a, I don't know, real way of doing it. But yeah, I think Michael, all good points. I mean, the only thing I would kind of add is that there's this very big difference between online marketing services and transaction services growth. So you see, and they did mention this on the call, and the response was, you know, I'll say it in a second. But so online marketing services grew 71%, while transaction services grew 38%. So quite a bit big difference there. And you would think, you know, with GMV increasing 79%, you'd think that transaction services would also go up. But actually, Pinduoduo says they're subsidizing transaction services, and in that case at least they're reducing their revenue. So kind of my sticking point has always been, I've had a couple sticking points with Pinduoduo. The first is this idea of restricted cash and this accounting standard update that made it so companies could put restricted cash in their cash from operations without having to kind of separate it out in a line item. And it's created this phenomenon where people think that super positive cash from operations is like just amazing. Because if you look at Pinduoduo, I mean, their business model and what they're doing creates a ton of restricted cash. And if you don't take that out of the cash from operations, you think this company is just like killing it. And they have this like amazing, you know, business with negative working capital. But the thing about restricted cash is you can't even use it. So even if you have like 15 or whatever days to pay it off, to pay it back to merchants, you can't use it because it's restricted in the bank account. And so banks will not let you use it. And that's why it's kind of set up like this. So it's always interesting when I read, you know, people writing about Pinduoduo for the first time and they look at the cash flow statement and they don't dive in any farther and they're kind of like, oh, wow, look at this. It's amazing, and kind of keep going. But actually, you got to look a little closer. You know, restricted cash just as a percent of GMV has been significant, like to the tune of almost 10%. Used to be more than 10%, but it's kind of come back up. Last quarter, it was 9.3%. These are kind of all things. So what I did is, because, you know, I would love to compare all these businesses based on, you know, earnings and margins and all this stuff, but Pinduoduo does not have kind of earnings yet. So I was wondering, okay, what do analysts expect? When do they expect Pinduoduo to be EBITDA positive? And I took a look on the old Bloomberg, and it's next year, 2021. And so they estimate, you know, the average, and this is an average of a bunch of different analysts, but they estimate to have a positive 1.9 billion EBITDA in 2021. But the funny thing is, analysts also estimate a negative 2 billion in operating income. And this is the problem with taking averages of line items of a bunch of different models, is because they're all going to be very, very different. It's funny because historically operating profit and EBITDA have a less than 1 billion RMB difference. And here the average is, you know, say there's a 4 billion RMB difference. So, I mean, there's just no way this would work in my opinion, without even looking at each model. There's something serious here. I think negative EBIT, so earnings before interest and tax, has actually gotten more negative with revenue growth, which suggests that there's some variable expense tied to revenues, you know, probably like sales and marketing and coupon incentives. But, you know, what do I know? The operating profit was the worst in 2018. And then in 2019, it kind of improved significantly. So it went from minus 82% to minus 28%. And then in the last trailing 12 months, you know, in this most recent quarter, it got a little worse. It's down to minus 30%. So not improving in the last 12 months. And that's, you know, I mean, Pinduoduo, they've had an amazing run. You know, my qualms and problems with them make it so like I'm not going to be long the stock. But if you want to focus on just revenue growth, you know, they do have it. I mean, 71% in online marketing services, very, very good. Now, the thing that, you know, I mentioned coupons and sales and marketing. The thing I should say is, you know, Q1 sales and marketing was 112% of revenue. Q2, the most recent one, it was just 75% of revenue. So you did see some decline quarter on quarter. And you know what, Michael, like you said, they're not seeing triple digit GMV growth. It might be because they kind of pulled back on the gas pedal there on the sales and marketing coupon and incentives. So the other thing, you know, there are other costs, you know, so sales and marketing is just one of the other costs. There's also G&A, which is 3% of revenue, and that's very, very, very reasonable. And then there's R&D, which is 14%. So you start adding these things up, and you get 92% of revenues is just operating expenses. And then you look at, cost of revenues, you take all this out, you're not making money on an operating basis. You know, you're negative 30% on a trailing 12-month operating margin, minus 13% for the quarter. So quite a bit better than it has been. But yeah, I know I'm a little skeptical. I think Pinduoduo has done a great job bringing users to e-commerce, helping users trust, the package delivery systems, and that if you buy things, they kind of work. Now, and Michael, you might know more about this, but my quick look at Pinduoduo and their app and stuff, I don't see much like quality products. So I wonder, I don't know if you guys have had this experience, but you buy something and if it breaks and you buy another one and then it breaks again, you kind of go, all right, I think I'm done with this, like spending less money on like a cheap product that doesn't last. Because you actually, if you calculate your replacement and life cycle of crappy cheap products, and you just compare that what you'd have to spend versus just buying one quality product that lasts a long time, I mean, you end up actually saving more money buying the quality product in many cases. So I do wonder.
A few things to say here. Now, obviously, I've worked with Pinduoduo quite a bit, so I am not an unbiased observer here. But a few things there is, I mean, when we started talking about Pinduoduo, I mean, I don't think either one of us were particularly bullish on them when we started this podcast, and they were $20 a share, and now they're over $80 a share, even after the dip. So, I mean, they've been, I've had reason to doubt them, but they seem to keep the ball rolling. Where I think that my question with them is about institutionalization, because I think that is a kind of an underemphasized aspect with a lot of these companies, particularly in China, is which one of them becomes an indispensable resource. And I think that when it comes to agriculture with Pinduoduo, that this seems to be an area where they're investing a lot of resources, and also just where they're focusing on quite a bit. And when you look at GMV, I mean, the third largest retailer in the U.S. is Kroger. Right, it's produce, right? Largely, and other fast moving consumer goods. Considering how crucial agriculture is to kind of China's long term strategic interests, and also how Pinduoduo does seem to have a little bit of a leg up in that area, I think that's one area that I think I'm watching quite a bit, and I think that when it comes to their future, or at least their security as being kind of one of these three big pillars, I think that that's where it lies. But we'll see. I truly don't know.
Yeah, I was really excited about the agriculture, confirmation. We had heard it before late last year, especially in the annual report. PDD had sort of laid the foundation for some broader moves into agriculture. So what's the importance of agriculture to PDD? Well, really, there's a chunk of PDD's GMV, about 14%, that comes from produce and related goods. 40% of its annual active buyers purchase from that category at a 70% repurchase rate. So it's clearly something that their buyers want. And being able to digitize farming operations, being able to have some, data coming back to those farmers about, what's in demand and the like, I think that this is a fertile ground for investment. And you'll recall from my article at the top of the year, I said that the next chapter in PDD's growth story should be it investing, being able to spot opportunities, disconnects, dislocations in social commerce, whether in China or around the world, and expanding that remit to agriculture, I think, is interesting. For those folks who have the time and the inclination, this idea of going deep, going vertical on a subcategory that an e-commerce platform happens to be quite good at is called being a 产业中台. So it's said that the idea here is once you've got enough users who are interested in the product and you can have your finger on the pulse in terms of what folks want, you can start then putting the pieces together across the value chain to be able to provide greater value for the users. So I was glad that they formalized this. The thing that I think is going to be difficult for folks going forward is that find me the analyst who is China times e-com times agriculture. I'm going to say that that person doesn't exist.
One person, maybe? I don't know.
I mean, really, the idea of you being across all these things, so being across PDD's user base, its penetration, its velocity, its competition with established players, that's one thing. That in and of itself is maybe a full-time job for some. And then to be able to try and go, well, you know, agricultural penetration, you know, e-commerce penetration in agriculture in China, it's about 7%, plus the digitization of farming, feeding information back to farmers and being able to have all different types of tech and non-tech interventions in this value chain. And you're trying to combine that experience in one individual. I think that's going to be pretty tough for the folks who are following PDD, whether you're an armchair observer or whether you do this for a living. I reckon it's going to be tough. And at that point, you have to come back to your three buckets of, hey, what can I, you know, get across? What can I get across at a stretch? And what's too hard basket? And for me, looking at this now, you know, it's getting staggeringly complex to be across everything.
Yeah, yeah. But I said this at the beginning, and I really think, I don't know if these companies will agree with me in this. I don't know if this is how they want to characterize themselves. But the way that I define kind of the story of each of these three is that, you know, Alibaba is the ecosystem and kind of has the muscle and the monopoly power. JD is kind of the quality and the kind of the high-end brand, and they can go into any area maybe after someone else does, but they will do almost anything that they do well. And then Pinduoduo is digitizing the undigitized, right? Whether it's, you know, users who just have a cell phone for the first time and they're just getting used to e-commerce, or now when it's agriculture, right? These areas where there is an opportunity for digitization and getting there first and kind of cornering that market. I think that is kind of the three big stories for these three companies. But I don't know if anyone else would agree with me on that one. But that's kind of what I see as kind of three big themes.
I think those make sense. I think on agriculture, I mean, my first kind of cynical take on it when I heard Pinduoduo talk about it in over the last few quarters, I mean, it's not just a brand new thing, but I've always thought it was kind of a government relations sort of poverty alleviation sort of angle there, because farmers, you know, in China have had kind of a rougher go of it. They had really bad tax policies that worked against them in the 90s and I think 80s as well. But, and then also the structure of agriculture, you know, people have kind of smaller plots and it's a lot of manual labor. There's not, if you have smaller plots, it doesn't really make sense to invest in the CapEx to buy like, you know, farming equipment that would cover much larger acreage. So, you know, there's that. And then when they do kind of are able to consolidate land into a larger amount of acreage, you know, the farmers that own the land have to lease it out to those bigger groups. And obviously, what are the terms of that and how does that work in the farmer's interest? And, you know, there's kind of land use right problems and there's all sorts of little kind of hairy things that I kind of know a little bit about because I worked in,
there's
hydroelectricity for a while. And we had, you know, we dealt with some farmers because hydro dams do create rising water levels, which does cover some farming land. But the there's a lot of kind of I do wonder, you know, digitizing that and kind of the fragmented nature of it. I mean, I get why analysts might be excited when they see a 7% of online, you know, e-commerce number and it's really small, you know, and then that creates this idea that there's a very large TAM. You know, you take the revenue, divide it by 7%, and that's your kind of potential, you know, growth there. It's huge. But I do, you know, that's like 15x growth in that. But I do wonder, you know, if it's definitely going to be a difficult one, which makes it maybe more interesting, because if you do succeed in it, it may be it's a little harder to copy in that case.
But here's another thing here. Okay, so yes, like I think that a point that you made is actually really, really, you know, key there, is that Chinese agriculture is incredibly inefficient, right? That if you go out to these fields, right, it is 40-acre plots. It's people, you know, old dudes plowing it by hand that'll probably be retired in 5 to 10 years. So one, that's an opportunity to, like, when it comes to scale, make this more efficient. You know, the fact that it is so inefficient means that that there are kind of you're tapping the gold mine, you know, before anyone else does, I think. And, you know, obviously that's a very bullish view, but I think that for anyone in China's agricultural sector, there is so much to gain there because it really hasn't been tapped so much. But the other side of that as well is that, you know, anyone who's studied China and its demographics and its agriculture knows that China has a huge problem producing enough food for all of its people. And it has for centuries or millennia. And right now, as China's kind of geopolitical situation is souring a bit, you know, they import so much food and so many agricultural goods from the U.S., from Canada, from these countries that they're you know, kind of not having so good of relationships with, and having a...
It's the only country on Earth with a strategic pork reserve.
Right, exactly. So if you can apply digital tools and supply chain and use things like AI and digitization to improve the efficiency of that, that is something that not only is going to help you know, you as a business, but it's also going to give the you know, the powers that be within China reason to support you and reason to root for your well-being, which is not a bad problem, a bad problem to have, exactly. So that would be my somewhat biased bullish case there. But that's my thought on that.
So, but one of the reasons China imports so much food is not because of inefficiency; it's because of a lack of arable land.
Well, that's part of it. That's part, you know, of efficiency.
It's percentage wise, in terms of land mass, is very, very low. Just the quality of the soil and kind of just, it's just not, you can't grow much on it. Now, that's fixable. I mean, Brazil did some really interesting stuff where I forget what it was. It might have been limestone or some ground up minerals, and they flew over these just giant plains where nothing was growing.
That big, yeah.
This was like in the 60s or 70s, I think. And then over the years, I mean, now they're an agricultural powerhouse because they have all this land that is now usable. It's been kind of reinvigorated.
And they cut down half the rainforest.
So, yeah. I mean, that too. Yeah, yes, that probably helps too. And rainforest soil is probably insanely nice.
No, it's actually really inefficient, especially for how they use it for gravy. Anyways, we're at an hour 20. We could just talk about everything. Anyways, we should wrap things up. So,
Michael, thanks for coming on, man. We're going to have to do another episode with the Ant Group IPO deep dive. Maybe, I don't know. Would you be interested in joining for that?
Sure, that sounds cool, and plenty more companies on your watch list of reported earnings. So happy to jump back on.
Right, Meituan, Tencent.
Yeah, Tencent.
Bilibili.
And Bilibili. Yep, exactly. So look, happy to jump on at any time. I think the thing for me, you know, this episode has been, it's not business as usual. There's enough that's changing and enough that's moving to, you know, make you get out the notebook again, cross some stuff out, and start jotting down some new thoughts.
There's never a dull moment on this podcast. Michael, tell our listeners how they can follow you and read your stuff.
So cool. So on my Twitter feed, you can find me at Brief Norris, where I write semi-disparaging things about different companies from time to time. And then you can see my more professional side on LinkedIn, Michael Norris, where I talk a lot more about the Chinese consumer and trends in consumption in the mainland based on my research at Agency China.
All right. And James, how can our listeners follow you?
Yeah, so I'm James Hull X, H-U-L-L-X on Twitter. And I think I'm James M. Hull on LinkedIn. But I think I haven't been active on either of these platforms just because I have a new infant. And I could probably record an entire podcast about what I've been learning and all the things about new fatherhood kind of experiences, but I won't get into that now.
Do babies have an online social network?
Some
can hear little Jim Jim's goo goo gagas.
It's
hot takes.
It's an interesting, some people post that stuff. We're not really posting it. I don't know. I feel like it's kind of, I don't know. It, like, this generation, some kids are going to grow up and they're going to have their entire life. I mean, like, from the very beginning to whenever age they are at any point, they're going to have their entire life on social media. And that's, like, just kind of weird to me. I don't know. I haven't really processed that.
And Facebook has photos of them since when they're babies, you know? Like, it's a you don't know what they're going to be able to do with that by the time that they're 50. Anyways, but that is the those are the stresses of being a new parent. So
I mean, that is very low on the stress rating. that's not a big. I mean,
if he's healthy,
just for the other dads out there, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, one of the things, the first thing I just had this amazing realization is, like, I only have two arms, you know. And, like, when you have a baby in your arms and you're trying to do things and, like, do stuff, you just want more arms, but you don't have them. So you're just – it's this, like, insane limitation that you never think about. You never really ever think about it.
Get a Dr. Octopus that shit, man.
Yeah, Shiva. Yeah,
I'm sure, you know, Spider-Man's Dr. Octopus, you know.
Go-Go Gadget. Yeah.
They didn't realize that these people were all just busy dads. You know, that's really what led them to villainy, you know, is that they...
That's all these writers came up with.
Yeah. Anyways. Okay. And I am, Elliot Zagman, Elliott Zagman. Also, go to technode.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China Tech. And you can catch us next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now, everybody.